It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Have you noticed how oaky California Chardonnay has fallen out of favor? Well, we forget how that Chardonnay fad started. That old Chardonnay's plush oakiness put California whites on the map. And some say it was one man who came up with the idea, Jess Stone Street Jackson of Kendall Jackson Wines. Well, today we talk with Jackson's biographer, Edward Humes.
Jackson was a game changer. He really was a kind of Steve Jobs of wine and invented a whole category. He cast aside a very successful law career, mortgaged his house, invested everything into opening a winery that pretty much everyone said would fail. And he ended up putting Chardonnay on America's tables.
Interesting legacy, right? Lots more coming your way this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Can anyone really own a food? For instance, quinoa, that ancient grain of the Andes that many consider a superfood. The United Nations declared 2013 the International Year of Quinoa. Its value is skyrocketing. In a matter of months, organic quinoa has gone from about $3 a pound to $8 a pound. The stakes are really rising. Well, we're turning to journalist Lisa Hamilton. She, working with the Food and Environment Reporting Network, authored an article in Harper's Magazine. It's The Quinoa Quarrel: Who Owns the World's Superfood? Lisa, it's good to have you with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Lynn.
So, what is it with quinoa? Tell me, why is this so important?
Well, there's a growing number of people who think that quinoa could be an incredible tool for addressing issues of food security in the uncertain future of population growth and climate change. And it begins with the fact that quinoa is an extraordinarily nutritious food. It has calcium, iron, essential fatty acids. It's also the only plant food to offer a complete protein. So it's on par with milk and eggs in some ways. But that's complemented by the fact that it agronomically is incredibly resilient. It will grow in places that other food crops won't, places with drought, places with salty soils, places that are cold. So there are a growing number of people who think that it could help increase food production, particularly in marginal lands, which is something that we're going to need in the future.
Where is it grown now?
Well, the challenge is that quinoa is native to the Altiplano, which is the high plain that stretches through the Andes in South America, in Bolivia, Peru, and Ecuador. And it's a very unique environment. Its lowest points are at 11,000 feet above sea level, and the soil is poor, the air is thin, the sun is blazing there. And even during the summer, there can be these bone-chilling winds. This is where the vast majority of quinoa still grows. In order for it to grow around the world, it needs to be bred by plant breeders down to lower altitudes. And we're not talking about genetic engineering. We're talking about just conventional, classical plant breeding. But in order to do that, plant breeders need seeds. The trouble is that those seeds, that genetic diversity, are owned by the people of the Andes. And they are not interested in sharing them.
Well, you know, it does raise a philosophical question, doesn't it? Because from what I understand, quinoa has been growing there for thousands of years, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, when you frame it quickly like this, it seems sort of selfish of the indigenous people of the Andes to not share their seeds. But as you talk with people there, as I did for this article, you get a larger perspective on it. The Altiplano is populated largely by indigenous Aymara and Quechua people. It was their ancestors who domesticated quinoa thousands of years ago. And the Altiplano is one of the poorest places in the Western Hemisphere. Within Bolivia, one of the poorest countries in the world, quinoa is this rare economic opportunity. But that's not the whole story. When I was in Bolivia reporting this story, I met a quinoa farmer named Herman Nina. And I met him in his quinoa field, but when he agreed to be interviewed, he said that he wanted to do it at the top of a volcano that rises just above his town in the southern Altiplano. And so on Easter Sunday, we went up this volcano called Tunupa from 12,000 feet at the base up 3,000 feet. And I've, you know, sort of struggling at that altitude. The quinoa farmer, Herman, was chugging along in front of me, politely stopping every once in a while. We got to the top, looked out over the land, his quinoa fields at the very base, and he said, Tunupa, this volcano, is the origin of life. For him and other Aymara people, this volcano was a god, and it was this god who gave them quinoa. And so while our conversation touched on things like patents and international treaties and nutrition, really he wanted to have it in a context of the cultural, spiritual importance of this plant to him and his people.
And this is where I think things get so complicated because, I mean, does anybody really have a right to say to someone else, you have to share what is perhaps either indigenous or has been part of your culture, a main, you know, or bedrock of your culture?
Well, you know, I think it's a really good question. And for decades, perhaps even centuries, the Bolivians did share their quinoa gladly because there was no reason not to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for thousands of years, seeds were simply part of the commons. They were shared freely, and even as valuable as they were, no one ever considered that you could actually own them. But then in the mid-20th century came intellectual property, and particularly with patents, suddenly there was this concept of ownership introduced. So as soon as someone is allowed to take seeds out of the commons and own them, then everyone has to own their plants, because if they don't, then someone else might come along and take them. So even if you don't believe in ownership, as the Aymara don't, you need to stake your claim so that other people can't exploit what you're holding.
Lisa, thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
Lisa Hamilton's article, The Quinoa Quarrel, Who Owns the World's Greatest Superfood, is in the May 2014 issue of Harper's Magazine. Now, for your own taste of that superfood, head to splendidtable.org and make up a batch of green apple and macadamia nut quinoa from Jane Coxwell. You're going to find that and a whole lot more on that website, splendidtable.org. Chardonnay, the wine that put California whites on the map in the 80s, still is the first wine we think of when asked, "Want to drink a white?" Some say one man's vision is responsible for this, Jess Stone Street Jackson of the Kendall Jackson Wine Empire. Edward Humes, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, makes his first foray into the wine world with his Jackson biography, A Man and His Mountain. Noelle Carter met with Edward.
Edward, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
What was it that drew you to Jess Jackson?
Well, you know, Jackson was a game changer. He really was a kind of Steve Jobs of wine in his own way and invented a whole category. He cast aside a very successful law career, mortgaged his house, invested everything into opening a winery that pretty much everyone said would fail. And he ended up putting Chardonnay on America's tables.
You describe him in the book as this bigger-than-life man with kind of the Midas touch. He's passionate, charismatic, and at times ruthless.
That's a good summary. I don't have too many billionaires on my Rolodex, but he was a very easy person to be around, very knowledgeable, kind of a Renaissance guy. But the thing that I found most interesting about him was his very complete contrarian streak.
Yeah.
You know, his Midas touch really emanated from doing things that people said probably would fail. That was his motivation to then prove them wrong. And he just seemed to be ahead of the curve on a lot of things that became trends after he blazed the trail.
Well, you know, you mentioned describing him as the Steve Jobs of the wine industry and Kendall Jackson itself as sort of the Starbucks of the wine industry. How exactly did he transform the industry?
He was one of the relatively small band of winemaking pioneers in the late 70s and early 80s who changed California's image and put it on the map of quality wines in a way that hadn't been true before. And interesting, because Kendall Jackson became very large, but it remained a family enterprise. It's, in fact, other than the very different Gallo family company, Kendall Jackson is the last of the great California wine family-owned companies. And Jess was kind of a micromanager for much of the life of the company, even when it had become so vast. He had this vision of the affordable luxury of wine, and this first Chardonnay he made became kind of a cash cow. It's been enduringly popular, one of the most popular Chardonnays in the world for many, many years. But it wasn't very expensive. People could afford to have it. He was catering to the everyday person's palate rather than the very elite wine culture. And that both irritated and entranced his critics and peers.
It seems that as successful as he became and as successful as Kendall Jackson and his other enterprises became, he always viewed himself as the everyman and the underdog.
Yes. Yeah, the billionaire underdog is a bit of a contradiction in terms. Again, there's the contrarian streak. But it goes back to his roots. He grew up very poor in San Francisco and worked a zillion jobs. You know, we tried to count how many different jobs he had over the course of his life, and we stopped at 50. You know,
wow.
He was a Berkeley cop. He was a lumberjack. He sold newspapers on the corner of San Francisco when he was a kid, and ended up putting himself through law school, a very successful career that he worked hard to build. Then put all that aside and threw himself into wine in a way that had a huge impact on his industry. You know, it's kind of one of the great second acts in American entrepreneurial history. But that wasn't really where he was at the start of Kendall Jackson. What he had was a winery that was hanging by a thread financially, a vintage in which the fermentation had become stuck for the Chardonnay grapes that he was growing in Lake County, and needed a solution. He kind of brought in these consultants, these young winemakers, the skunk works of wine, to try and fix it. And their idea was to respect the terroir of different grapes that he had either grown or bought, and do 7 or 8 different vintages, very small ones, and try and stanch the losses and stay alive financially. And he said, I can't, you know, I'm one guy with a winemaker and my daughter's working for me. I can't market 8 different kinds of wines.
Right.
And so it was really necessity that drove him to this idea of making a blend, which horrified all these winemaking consultants he was working with. And he said, no, I want to make a wine that blends all the best grapes from the coastal regions of California and call it a super blend. And let's see. Let's taste it. And he said, don't you think it tastes good? And he said, yes, but you can't do that. It tastes fine, but you can't do that. Why can't I do it? I can do it.
What I loved was he took something that would have horrified other winemakers. And not only does he market that, but that becomes the whole selling point for the wine. And you mentioned when he started doing these tastings, he would invite people to blend their own wines just so they could see what a wonderful blend his was and how difficult it is to do the right blend.
He brought in wine critics and writers and journalists and industry people and fed them and then sat them down in this room with all the different wines that were the components of his Vintner's Reserve Chardonnay and said, you make it. You see, you say.
It was a fascinating way to sell, yeah.
And it was. And people loved it. I mean, it was fun. And there's no arguing with success. It was hugely popular and became even more so after Nancy Reagan started pouring it at the White House.
Right.
And that made news in San Francisco and then nationally. It was, you know, it was Nancy's wine, and it really caught fire after that. So, you know, he hit something that people liked, and the critics be damned, and tradition be damned. But then he threw it out. Everybody started making blends. He says, well, no, now I'm going to make estate wines, and I'm going to focus on the terroir.
And he started buying all the fine little wineries.
Yeah. And also acquiring raw land that he converted to vineyards in areas that hadn't previously been used for winemaking, but he felt had a lot of promise, and he was really successful in that.
Edward, I really want to thank you so much for talking with me today. This book was such a fascinating read.
Well, thank you, Noelle. It's been a pleasure.
Ed Hume is author of A Man and His Mountain, the everyman who created Kendall Jackson and became America's greatest wine entrepreneur. Contributor Noelle Carter is the Los Angeles Times Test Kitchen Director and writes the Culinary SOS column. Well, Father's Day is right around the corner, and we've pulled together some recipes for the occasion. Think homemade onion dip, spice-crusted oven-baked spare ribs, ginger sesame coleslaw, and a brownie sundae with smoked almonds and caramel. And that's just to get you started. Check it out at splendidtable.org. Coming up, healthy summer eating inspiration from Diana Henry and cooking myths busted. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Crack open one of Diana Henry's books and you're drawn into a world of sensual pleasures. Her recipes take notes from all over the world. Roast fish with spiced eggplant, lemon, and honey, Uzbeki-style carrots, cucumber and yogurt soup with walnuts and rose petals. Get the idea? Well, her book, A Change of Appetite, actually chronicles a year when Diana had a change in appetite. Our contributor, Melissa Clark, got the story.
So, Diana, your book is about how you changed your appetite. Tell me about that change.
Well, I had quite a lot of friends who kept talking about eating more healthily. They're like me. They're in their late 40s. Either they wanted to eat healthy or they wanted to put their partners on a healthier diet. And I think it's partly to do with getting older. And when I asked them what they were cooking at home, because they were trying to cook protein and vegetables, basically, they were all trying to think of, you know, a million and one things to do with a turkey breast, and it really wasn't exciting. And I thought, this is kind of grim. So I thought, I will start to think about what is healthy, but I won't come at it from the health position. I'll come at it from the delicious position, because I'd never liked the idea of healthy eating myself. I know I've kind of come around to it. And when I started to think of dishes that were actually good for you, I realized that that was more, you know, more, most of the time were dishes that I wanted to eat anyway. So it's Middle Eastern food, Southeast Asian food, kind of stuff that's light and it has got a lot of vegetables in it, whole grains, lots of what I call front of the mouth flavors like chili and garlic and lime and ginger.
In your book, you talk about foods that are accidentally healthy, foods that you love anyway.
That was my little catchphrase that I kept thinking of when I was trying to come up with the dishes to go in the book. And it was food that was delicious first and then happened to be very good for you second. And there's loads of it, Melissa. I mean, you know what it's like. Nowadays, we can get ingredients for any cuisine. So Vietnamese, Indian, Lebanese, you can get everything.
Middle Eastern cuisine comes up a lot in your book. I see you're using pomegranate molasses, you're using cumin and yogurt.
I started to cook those when I moved to London. I'm from Northern Ireland. And as I grew up in Ireland, we had nothing exotic whatsoever. And I used to read the Arabian Night stories. And I used to dream about things like that, figs and pomegranates and that kind of thing. And when I moved to London after I was at university in England, it was just, I mean, it kind of bowled me over, because at the end of my street in North London, there was a Turkish, there was a Cypriot, there was a Middle Eastern store, and all this stuff was there. And then I discovered Claudia Roden, who's one of my favourite food writers, and I started to cook like that and eat also in cheap little Middle Eastern restaurants in London. And I've never lost the taste for that. I adore it. It's probably my favourite cuisine, to be honest. They just cook so brilliantly with vegetables. I mean, in England, we haven't really. They've been a thing that sits on the side, and they really put vegetables foremost, and they use other ingredients that sort of bring them to life.
And have you moved vegetables? We talk a lot about vegetables moving to the center of the plate. Is that part of your philosophy for this book?
Do you know, it kind of is, but it happened accidentally. I think my eating had changed a bit anyway over the last sort of gradually over the last decade. And I was eating a lot more vegetables, partly because I've kind of got more ideas about what to do with them. I find that meat is kind of meat, you know, and especially if it's something good like a steak, you don't really want to fancy that up. You just want the steak. But when it comes to vegetables, I mean, there's a whole section in my book about carrots, and carrots are something that I love. But I have about five different carrot salads. There's one from Burma, there's one from Mandalay, there's all sorts of places. And so I started to think more creatively, I think, about vegetables, but it came about quite naturally. I didn't force it.
And what are some of your favorite summer recipes for the book? I mean, I think we all want to start eating lighter this time of year.
Oh, this is the best time of year. If you're going to start being a bit more healthy, this is a good time of year to do it, because you can kind of ease yourself in and then you'll be really used to it by the time autumn comes around. But I kind of go all over the place looking for ideas. There's lamb kebabs with a Georgian sauce called azika, which is made with celery, lots of chilies, red peppers, and this is all blitzed together with garlic in the food processor. Then you add, they put things together differently there, so they use dill and coriander together, and it has a little red wine vinegar and some olive oil, and it's fierce. It's really hot. I mean, you eat it and you go, oh, wow, it's a real shock. But to have that with something as simple as lamb kebabs and then a salad of barley and tomatoes on the side, that's lovely, and it's not difficult, but it's different. I'm very keen on labneh. I don't know if you make it as well, that Middle Eastern drained cheese. I mean, it sounds ridiculous to say that you kind of make your own cheese, but everybody's got so into it now, because all it is draining Greek yogurt inside a piece of muslin or cloth. Then you're able to, after 24 hours, you can unwrap this and you can break it into nuggets. So one of my favourite summer things is tomatoes that have been roasted in the oven with Moroccan harissa. And that this works even when you have tomatoes that aren't wonderful, because it concentrates the sweetness in them. The heat does that. And then they're sweet and also very peppy because of the harissa. And I serve that with little nuggets of labneh. So you have the warm tomatoes, the coldness of the labneh, and then torn bread, sort of flat bread that you've toasted, so bits of pita bread, and lots of herbs. So as well as leaves, I think it's important to use herbs as a salad leaf. So there's lots of coriander in that. And then there's a saffron dressing on top of it. So you just dissolve your saffron in either white wine vinegar or lemon juice, and then you go ahead and make a dressing with it, adding your olive oil after that. And, you know, not only do you have different flavours in that, but you have got contrasting temperatures and textures as well, because the bread is toasty and the tomatoes are soft. So I love those things where you can kind of compose things and you have a lot going on in your mouth all at the one time. If you're eating that, you don't think, I'm missing steak or I'm missing chicken. You're very happy with what you have.
Diana, it's been lovely talking to you. Happy summer.
You too. Bye-bye.
Diana Henry is author of A Change in Appetite. Melissa Clark is food columnist for the New York Times and author of Cook This Now. Now, Diana left us with a couple of recipes for summertime eating, including nectarine tomato and basil salad with torn mozzarella. And you're going to find them all at splendidtable.org. Chef Daniel Klein and videographer Mira Fine crisscross the planet, discovering how and what people are eating all over the globe. They documented on their award-winning site, theperennialplate.com. And they show up here to talk about their adventures. Mira, Daniel, good to have you back.
Thank you for having us.
Great to be here.
So you've been in Argentina. What were you looking for? What did you find?
So we found ourselves in the jungle. And this time we are in northern Argentina, with a man named Alex Pryor, who founded Guayaki, which is a yerba mate company.
For those who aren't familiar, yerba mate is a tea that is very popular in Argentina, Paraguay, and Uruguay. And it's a bitter tea that you drink out of a gourd. And it's you can put sugar in it, but you pour in hot water and sip it out of a what's called a bombilla, which is a metal straw with a sieve at the end.
It's bitter?
I think if you're not used to drinking it, I think it comes across initially as bitter. It's a little vegetal, but it's got a it's appealing in its bitterness.
Right. I see.
I didn't find it actually very bitter. Daniel was surprised that I liked it at all, because before we drank it, he was like, you're not going to like this. Because he said that usually it takes a while to get acclimated to it, but I thought it was pretty good. They said that usually women like to put sugar in it. They don't like to drink it straight.
It's interesting.
It's originally grown on the jungle floor. That's where it was discovered. Uh-huh. But since industrialization happens to everything, it's now grown, you know, in deforestation and huge plots in the sun. But he's trying to bring it back to the original form, which is below the jungle floor. So he's planted all of these different original varieties in the jungle floor.
So here you are. You're walking through the jungle. What happened?
We got there at night. And we went to this hut that was in the middle of the jungle that Alex had built. It had no sides on it. It was completely open. And we were sitting around this wood stove and listening to all the crazy frogs and animal sounds in the distance. Because when you're in the jungle, like, there's nothing. I mean, it's just There's nothing, but at the same time, you're surrounded by all these bugs. It's almost like a heartbeat of squeaks and croaks and all this stuff. And so we're sitting around and passing around this gourd because drinking mate is very much it's a big traditional thing, and it's also a very cultural thing. It's about community, and it's about, like, sharing. So you sit around, and the main person is called I don't speak Spanish, cebador or chebador, and they fill it three-quarters of the way with these dried, chopped leaves.
Right.
And then they put this straw in, the bombilla, which is a silver metal straw, and at the bottom it's almost, like, squished into, like, a duck bill.
Oh.
And it has holes in it so that only the beverage
liquid
can come in. Yep.
It's like a built-in strainer.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And so he pours in the water, takes a little drink, and then passes it to the next person who takes a sip. And there's all these rules around this ritual where you're supposed to look at the person when you give it to them. There's supposed to be an intention with giving it to them. You're supposed to have the straw face towards the person who you're giving it to because they're not supposed to move the straw at all because you could get it in an incorrect position and it could get the all the chunks of
right,
and you can't and you can't say thank you. If you say thank you, it means you don't want any more mate.
Which was really hard as Minnesotans because I kept on saying thank you,
which
means it shouldn't be passed to you again.
So there are all these the traditional techniques that were used before it became part of everyday culture in Argentina, and so Alex wanted to share with us all these different methods that were used prior to just the way that it's used in the cities,
mm-hmm.
and so he takes a receptacle, a bowl or a pot. He used a pot in this case. And he takes some coals out of the fire, puts it in the pot, then takes the mate leaves and sprinkles it over the coals so it starts to smoke and burns a little bit. Then right away he takes raw sugar and sprinkles that over the coals as well. And so it starts to caramelize. So you get this smoky caramel smell in the air. He kind of stirs it around for a minute and then takes warm water and pours it directly over the coals. So you've got this, you're essentially like creating this mate caramel drink.
Oh my.
So you drink it and it's smoky and it's sweet. And he said it tastes like the campo. That's like when people think back to how mate used to be when it was toasted over a fire, that's the flavor.
And the campo means country or the countryside.
Campo means countryside or farm.
Are Alex's mates, or is his mate singular, available here in the United States?
Yeah, it's called Guayaki, and they sell it at local co-ops and probably Whole Foods all over the place.
His company started in the U.S. when he went to college in the U.S., and he would bring his mate gourd to his classroom with his little, hot water.
Right.
They have it. Everyone, you know, Argentinians have it all over the place. Like, you're sitting on a train and someone will have a thermos with their hot water and, like, a little pouch of the yerba, which is the actual mate, the tea, and then their little gourd everywhere you go. And if you sit next to them, they'll offer it to you, or you can ask for it. Or Alex was telling us how he was sitting in a courtyard in Mexico and was putting his mate together. He was making it, and he saw this man staring at him. And a few minutes later, the man was sitting next to him and said, "Can I have some?"
And he knew. He knew.
Yeah, and then he does share, because that's what it's about. It's about this, like, sharing. He said it, like, elevates the conversation because it makes it more about, you know, you can talk for an hour over this mate.
What you find in the jungles of Argentina. Mira, Daniel, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Daniel Klein and Mira Fine are the creators of the award-winning perennialplate.com. Now, for more of their travels, head to the website splendidtable.org. All those unwritten kitchen rules, you know, bring your eggs to room temperature before baking, never dunk mushrooms in water. Well, what is fact and what is fiction here? Our managing producer, Sally Swift, has turned to Tim Cibola, Cooking Light's senior food editor, and he's author of the article, Why You Dredge, Rest, Pulse, and Process.
Hey, Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Sally.
Okay, so rumor has it you've been doing some sleuthing, looking at some of the whys behind all these unwritten rules that we follow in the kitchen.
Right. Yeah, we like to figure out these dilemmas for our readers.
It's a nice thing. So I want to start with a couple and have you walk me through them, if that works.
Absolutely.
The first one, a rule that my mother drilled into me over and over again about boiling potatoes, and the fact that she always said you have to start the potatoes in cold water, never drop potatoes into boiling water. Is that true? It is true.
Absolutely. It's true. And you wouldn't think it would require such TLC, but it does, because it's a little bit denser than a vegetable like, say, green beans, for instance. And the density means that it's going to take a little while longer for the inner temperature to match the exterior. And so if you drop it directly, say a cubed or quartered potato, directly into a pot of boiling water, what you're going to end up with is a potato that's mushy and gluey and crumbly on the outside and practically raw on the inside. Hmm. So the cold water, if you start in cold water, begins to raise its temperature gradually, giving the potato a chance to raise gradually with it, and then you're going to get a much more evenly cooked potato.
Wow, that makes complete sense. Who knew?
Yeah, right. Yeah, when you think about it, it makes sense.
And what about that rule about preheating pans in the oven before you roast vegetables? Is that really true? Is that something we need to follow?
It absolutely is, but it's something that a lot of us don't even think to do. While, oddly, we're all very aware of how important it is to preheat your pan on the stovetop before you add things in, the same principle applies here. When you preheat your pan for roasted vegetables, you're going to end up with less sticking and better browning. Mm. And this is particularly important with tender spring and summer vegetables, where if you start them in a cold pan, it's going to take that much longer in the oven while they roast for them to cook. And you're probably going to end up with mushy vegetables that don't get much browning. But if you preheat the pan and you lightly coat your veggies in oil, the minute they hit the pan, you're going to hear that sizzle just like mm-hmm. you should when you saute them.
Mm-hmm. So you get that sear. Does right. that work with proteins too? I never think about that.
Yeah, you know, it would work with proteins. The difference, though, is that when we're roasting proteins, we often tend to brown them on the stovetop first. But if you don't brown them on the stovetop for whatever reason, it's a great idea to get your roasting pan good and hot and then put the meat inside.
Mm-hmm. It would speed things up, I would think, too.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, we can all use a little extra time.
All right, I'm going to take on a sacred cow next. Onions. People have so many opinions about what the correct way is to slice an onion. Will you tell us once and for all what the difference is slicing around it, like from the equator, or slicing from pole to pole?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a polarizing topic, and people feel really strongly about it. But slicing from pole to pole or vertically is essentially to slice with the fibers, along with the fibers of the onion. So if you peel an onion, you will see that there'll be green lines that run vertically from pole to pole. And when you slice with these fibers, the onion pieces you end up with tend to hold up a little bit better as they cook.
Right. So if you want onions to hold their shape, you want to cut them pole to pole.
Exactly. And this is great for when you're long cooking onions, like in a caramelized onion, if you want the onions to be sort of separate and not mushed together in a jam. That's the way to do it. But then again, you might want them to mush together in a jam, and that's fine. And that's when you would cut them in half moons or across the equator, and then they're going to break down a little bit more.
Or, of course, dicing would do it even further, right? Then you're
exactly.
really wanting it to blend. That is interesting. That seems like the final word to me, I have to say.
I'm glad we could clear that up.
Wow, that's a tough one. We're going to get mail on that. I know it. What about this rule about when you are baking and you are mixing a batter and the instructions come back again and again to alternate the dry ingredients with the wet ingredients? Is there
right.
a method? Is there real science behind that?
There is a method to that madness. And it does seem a little fussy, and it's never really fully explained in recipe methods, but it's important to follow because what it comes down to is bubbles. So when you're mixing up a cake batter, it's the bubbles, unpopped and whole, that will give you the tender, open crumb in the cake that you want. So when you're beating sugar into softened butter, or when you're beating eggs into a frothy foam, you're getting these bubbles. And so to gradually add the dry ingredients is going to keep the bubbles from popping, and that's what you want for a nice, light, airy cake.
Mm-hmm.
Dump and stir is fantastic for something that's supposed to be more dense, like a brownie or something like that. But for the light, airy cake that you want, you got to keep those bubbles intact.
Huh. Science. Let's talk about tofu. More and more people are eating it.
Uh-huh.
Often you're told to press it to get some of the water out. Does that really do anything?
It sure does. Oftentimes, a lot of the tofu you're going to get, the firm and extra firm, comes packed in water. And so you press it with, say, you know, between paper towels and press it with like a heavy skillet or something for about 20 minutes to get the water out, because water, as we know, is the enemy of brown and crisp food. Mm-hmm. And if you want to saute these tofu cubes or tofu planks or however you slice them and get a nice golden crust on them, you've got to get that water out of there, or else they're just going to steam in the pan.
Mm-hmm. Tofu kind of needs it, you know?
It does, it does.
Thanks, Tim.
Sure. Thank you, Sally.
Tim Cibola is Cooking Light's senior food editor. Sally Swift is our managing producer. The article, Why You Dredge, Rest, Pulse, and Process, can be found in the June 2014 issue of Cooking Light. Now, we're going to be back in a minute with your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
I'm in the phone booth. It's a one across the hall. If you don't answer, I'll just ring it off the wall. I know he's there, but I just try to call. Don't leave me hanging on the telephone. Don't leave me hanging on the telephone.
We're connecting with you. Get to us at 800-537-5252. And remember, you can always get in touch on Facebook and Twitter. Okay, let's see who's up. We've got Josie calling from Pierce, South Dakota. Josie, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I want to talk about the fruits to flavor homemade ice cream. Every Sunday, we drive out to my family ranch out in the country. And, you know, my grandma's getting on in years, and one of the things that she really enjoys making is homemade ice cream. So we make homemade ice cream every once in a while as, you know, a special little treat.
Right.
And it's just, it's wonderful. But we are wondering what best fruit would be good to flavor it.
Oh, I think whatever is in season that tastes wonderful. Really wonderful. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that generally doesn't work in ice cream are melons. I'm not saying you can't make a good melon ice cream, but usually it's better to make a sorbet or, you know, whatever, because of all the water. But strawberries when they come into season, cherries, you know, think about how a good cherry tastes. It's
yeah.
a pain to pit them, but boy, a good cherry, absolutely fabulous in ice cream. Mangoes, believe it or not, peaches and nectarines. Another thing that makes really great ice cream, raspberries. You know, those really popular flavors that you see, they're
yeah.
telling us the message. Banana. There's a fabulous book out called Jenny's Splendid Ice Creams. Now, this and her formula that she uses, she produces ice cream in, I think it's Columbus, Ohio, in the farmer's market. And now she's I've just found that she's selling them around the country. But the book is just a wonderful book. And one of the tricks that she uses, because she gets these really intense flavors, she will roast the fruit. And part of that is to get rid of excess moisture, but part of that is to also intensify the flavor.
Wow.
Yeah, and generally speaking, I like to use, if I'm making a quart of ice cream, which technically is 4 cups, if I'm doing that, what I like to do is start out with about 2 cups of fruit that I add to it. I like a lot of fruit. But if you
yeah.
do that roasting, you get rid of the excess moisture. So you don't get, it's less chance of getting ice crystals. And
yeah.
it's more intense in flavor. So it's
all
worth,
right.
yeah, it's worth a try.
Yeah, yeah. And then also, what part of the process would you put the fruit in?
The fruit's the thing that gets stirred in at the end.
Yeah.
That's the real key. Now, if you're pureeing the fruit, that's different. If you're pureeing the fruit, you puree it with the ingredients. But I would say fruit goes in at the last because that's what you want to have it as pristine as possible.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Lynn.
You are welcome. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Eric's on the line from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Eric, what do you want to talk about?
Oh, and thank you. I'm planning a dinner party for some friends, and I'm looking for some recipe ideas. I'm kind of going with an unusual food or just unique combinations of foods, trying to get, you know, things that people haven't tried before. So I'm going to do like tacos de lengua. I'm going to do a savory cheesecake with blue cheese and shallots. I think I actually got it from your website, a chocolate cake with sauerkraut recipe. And another one that someone else is going to bring is a blueberry pie that has basil and goat cheese in it.
Oh, that's, and, this sounds great.
So I'm looking for some other ideas from you, other things that I can fill in those.
You know where my mind always goes when someone says unexpected combinations is putting chilies in a situation or onions or garlic that you'd never expect it. And one of the things we did last summer, there's this relish I love to do with onions. It's as hot as Hades. You take – what you do is you thin slice onions, okay? And I use red onions because they're pretty. And you take lime juice that you squeeze over them, you sprinkle them with salt, and then you puree a couple of jalapeno chilies, and you toss that all together.
Okay.
Now, the acidity of the lime juice is going to kill off some of the chili. And if you want, add a little sugar. And you just put that in the fridge overnight, and then it can hang out in the refrigerator in a jar for like, you know, 3 weeks. And we put it on everything. Burgers and whatever. Except one day when the peaches and the nectarines look really swell, I couldn't resist. I sliced them up and I put a few strips on the peaches and nectarines and I gave it some agave syrup.
Okay, yep.
It was fabulous.
Oh.
And you know what? Vanilla ice cream under that is great too. So
yeah.
That'll blow their minds. That'll blow their minds. I think that with the great desserts you're talking about, you could try that.
Yeah.
Or you could even serve it with blue cheese under it, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, and serve it as a first course with bread.
Okay.
And that would be kind of fun. Chunks of peaches, you know, it's sort of a bruschetta that the Italians would never have thought of.
Well, I could do, I've got a neighbor that does a lot of organic grains and makes his own flours, and he does a spelt flour. So I could even make some bread.
Oh, that would be
to
great.
Go with that.
And if you want to share recipes, we're wide open.
All right, excellent. Thank you so much for the information, Lynn.
You're welcome. You're welcome, Eric. Bye.
Bye.
800-537-5252. You know what I've been fooling around with lately? Peas and potatoes. As they say, 'tis the season. And the other thing that shows up in the market now are baby lettuces. Now, I don't mean to be cutesy-wootsy about all the baby vegetables, but what I discovered is baby bib lettuce is so juicy. It's like eating a steak. And the leaves are not very big. They're maybe 2 to 3 inches long, and they're kind of oval, and they're really delicious. And what I've been doing is I've been sort of – and they grow in clusters. And if you can get a hold of them where they're still attached at the base, you'll have like 6 or 8 of them. They look like you're laying out flowers on the plate. But if you put those leaves, cover a plate with those leaves, and then cut your little new potatoes, you know, the ones that are the size of maybe a golf ball at most or a marble, you cut those into a half inch dice. And then you take also sugar snap peas, equal amounts of both. And you take the sugar snap peas and you chop them into one-inch pieces. Take a pan of boiling water, drop the peas in, cook them just until they're really bright green and they are still crunchy. Pull them out with a slotted spoon and then drop the potatoes in there and cook them until they're just tender. Now, you can run cold water over both of those to chill it down. But the point is, that gets heaped onto those lettuces. It's like a whole treatise of spring, right? And then you make a dressing, grainy mustard, a bit of heavy cream, some lemon, and lots of fresh tarragon. And you just drizzle that over everything at the table. You can bring out a big plate of this salad, and then you just have the pitcher that you pass around. It is just so delicious, I cannot tell you. And I'm not going to put up the recipe. I am going to tell you this is all logic. We have Heather on the phone calling from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Heather, thanks for calling. What do you want to talk
Hi,
about?
Hi, Lynn. My question is about foods that are breaded and fried.
Yeah.
I'll use onion rings as an example, but really it includes other vegetables and meats that you might be breading and then frying.
Yeah.
I have trouble with the breading process.
In what way?
I dip the onion or whatever it is I'm breading into the egg mixture, then dip it in the breadcrumbs, and then you transfer it to the hot oil.
Yeah.
And some recipes, you have to dip it in flour also, or do like an egg, flour, egg thing.
Yeah, because it helps it all stick together. Yeah.
Right. At any rate, by the time my onion is in the pan, my breadcrumbs have lumps of goop in them from the egg. My hands are covered in goop, and the onion isn't completely coated with the breading. And this is just the first one.
And you've got a ton of them ahead of you, right?
Yeah.
Okay, first of all, whenever you're going to you know, do that kind of process with any food where you're dipping it and you're going to deep fry it with a batter, one of the things you want to do is to make sure that everything is really dry. And I know that seems weird since you're dipping it into egg, but you don't want any water on it. And so, you know, one of the things, I always pat the onion rings, you know, with paper towels, anything with paper towels. And one of the things that some people like to do is to do that egg dip, do a flour dip, go back to the egg, and then hit the breadcrumbs. But what you want to do is make sure you shake off things. You know, you dip in the egg, let it drip off. You go into the breadcrumbs, you toss them, have them in a shallow bowl, you toss them around in there, make sure everything's coated, and then just shake off. Just lift it and let anything fall off, and then drop it into the hot fat. And I think you should be okay. Yeah.
All right. I'll try that then.
Yeah, try that. And remember, fingertips or a fork, because I know what you mean. You end up just caked in gup. And yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You are welcome.
I appreciate it.
Okay. We have John Michael calling from Palm Springs, California. John Michael, what's on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for taking my call.
You are welcome.
Well, I run a bed and breakfast here in Palm Springs. We have been just getting so many amazing reviews for our food and so many requests for the recipes.
Congratulations. That's great.
Thank you very much. We're very proud of it, and we do want to share our recipes, and we wouldn't even mind making a little bit of money on selling a cookbook. But I figured you would be the one to speak to figure out where to start with writing something like that.
Well, I think the best way to begin, first of all, is to kind of get an overview. So look at all your recipes, look at the things that people seem to really enjoy, and that's your start right there.
Sure.
See how many you have and see how they balance out, you know, the sweet ones, the savory ones, the soups, you know, the way you would normally think about dividing up a cookbook.
Mm-hmm.
And you want only the best of the best of the best of what you do.
And then I was curious as to what you might think about how to sort of test out the recipes. I have things pretty well documented, but I want to be sure. I've heard you talk about that before.
This is the key. They have to work, and you have to know they work for different people. So what I would do if I were you is, first of all, I would take them into the kitchen and make them. Do you normally cook in large quantities?
We do, so that would be that'll be a lot of math.
Yeah. So what you want to do is not just math, though. You have to make sure it works. Do you mainly measure almost everything by weighing?
No, it's still mostly a cup or a dash or a handful.
Okay, this is really important then. Mm-hmm. You want to take those recipes and you want to make them for 8 people.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to do that breakdown. Now, you may want to hire someone to work with you because you're running a business.
Sure.
But hire a professional. Hire someone whose job it is to develop recipes as opposed to, I have a friend who likes to cook.
Right.
Because you're going to go to that friend in a little while. But first you want the pro who's going to break these down. But remember, the pro, it's your palate you're satisfying. So break that down so that you can say, here's a recipe that's going to serve 8, and I really know it works, and it ends up tasting the way the mass-produced one does. Then the next thing you're going to do is the friends. From everyone from a beginner cook to, you know, somebody who's been at it forever and really loves it, pass around the recipes, see what they want to do, and work out a form. I started out with a form for friends that they could just tick off. They didn't have to write anything.
Sure.
But, something about how easy was it for you to do this? Were the ingredients listed in a way that made sense to you? Did it take too much time? That kind of thing.
Sure,
and, of course, the ultimate thing, was it something you want to make again and again and you can't wait to eat again? Because that's what you want.
Right.
And then think about the stories you can tell in the headnotes.
Sure.
Because a headnote, it can take a day to write a headnote, sometimes two. But you want to give people an idea of the goodness of what they're making and of what sets it apart. And you want to have them, maybe if there is a story to tell, tell the story.
Sure.
And look at how cookbooks are organized. Look at the ones you really like to use. That'll tell you a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
And good luck with it. I think it's going to be great fun for you. And you could self-publish, and it could be sitting there right in the B&B, and in every room there could be a copy that
could be yours. My thoughts exactly. Thank you so much, Lynn.
Good luck, John Michael.
Thank you.
Bye. Well, that's the show for today. Be sure to join us next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Julia Child, who said, "If you're afraid of butter, use cream." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Visit splendidtable.org to catch up on everything you heard here today and so much more. Head to our podcast network, infiniteguest.org, to download podcasts of The Splendid Table and others, including Dinner Party Download, a fast and funny hour serving up culture, food, interviews, drink recipes, and other elements for a winning dinner party. Find Dinner Party Download on your podcast app. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalidi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Well, we'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.